This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly.
When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things that you love are checked by experts. Not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff with real hands-on authentication experience.
So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back.
Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other.
With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Fat Mascara. I'm Jen.
Hey, I'm Jess.
Hi, guys. It's Thursday. I love Thursday because we get a big, in-depth, juicy interview with someone we are really interested in the beauty industry. And this week, we have a good one. We have a good one. We have Jimmy Paul.
So, guys, I've been waiting for this one for a long time. Jimmy Paul is really one of my... I'm going to steal this phrase from Michael Gordon from Bumble and Bumble, or the founder of Bumble and Bumble. He is a hair hero of mine.
Ooh, yes.
And Jimmy Paul actually worked with Bumble and Bumble for some time. We'll get to that in the interview. He is one of those hairstylists who I really think doesn't just create hairstyles. He creates hair characters. He creates characters with his looks. And when you see a Jimmy Paul image, you know a Jimmy Paul image. So I don't want to take up too much time here banging on about how much I adore him. I think you're going to be able to tell just how fantastic this man is when you listen to the interview. What a story. What a life story. What a trailblazer. What a New York icon.
Oh, so New York. I was loving all the New York talk about. He took us through the years of like, the nightlife in New York. I learned so much other than about hair also. It was such a good interview.
Yeah, at a time where I feel like New York is really going through a renaissance, I think this was the perfect moment to have somebody who lived and breathed through some of New York's most incredible years. Just take us back to that time. So, Jimmy, thank you for your generosity. Thank you for just opening up about who you are and your story. Let's take it away, Jimmy. Jimmy, thank you so much for coming to Fat Mascara. I really, you know, you're just such an awesome, you know, person. You've got such a great story. And I really want our listeners to, you know, say, start from the beginning, but I want to know like just more about who you are. You know, they can, if they're not already familiar with your work, I urge everyone to go check out your Instagram. It's at just at Jimmy Paul. Is it at Jimmy Paul NYC or is it at Jimmy Paul?
Just Jimmy Paul Hair.
Oh, Jimmy Paul Hair. Okay, sorry. Yeah, I follow okay. you. So I just, you just come up. But do check out Jimmy's work and just be razzle dazzled by the beauty and the theatrics. But I want to get to know who you are a little bit more, like, you know, as a human. So tell us, where did you grow up? Let's start there.
Okay, I grew up in a little town called Swissvale, and it's outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's a little steel mill town. Like that's sort of the foundation. People moved there that worked at the local steel mill. So the whole town was sort of related to the steel mill. So, and all my ancestors worked there. And my mom was a hairdresser, is a hairdresser. She's retired, but.
Do you guys talk hair when you come home?
We talk hair and beauty. And my mom always wants to know like what supplements I'm taking or what, if I'm on a new diet or found any new food. Like, yeah, we talk about stuff like that. Yes, absolutely.
So yeah, you've definitely, you know, talked about your mom as an influence, yes. You know, in your work and in other articles, and you know, you've posted photos of your mom on True. Your Instagram. Can you talk a little bit about your mom as an influence in your work or just kind of who you are?
Yes, you know, like a lot of people, I grew up in a mostly single mom, single parent home. So I believe that, you know, my mother was super important to me because that's how I, instinctually, how I was surviving. This was the person who was, you know, helping me to be alive. And so I think what happened was that my mother became a very big influence on me. And one of the things that I loved was watching her get ready and the empowerment I saw in that. And it was a real, and the joy that she got. And then I remember that she would get happy when I would be happy with how she looked, you know, like it was a kind of a mutual joy of just my childhood.
Was she an influence on you then deciding to like make your way to New York and become a hairdresser? I'm sure she didn't want little Jimmy to leave her side.
Well, yes. Well, I kind of, I was a very, very good little boy. And then by the time that I got to adolescence, that kind of flipped and I became like a, I guess a kind of, to me, maybe not to anybody else, but more of like a bad kid. And I started to be defiant and start to become into alternative kind of music and things that my little very, very conservative blue collar neighborhood, I became like somebody from Mars, right? I became very different. And I became interested in, you know, very cerebral, like very bedroom culture. Like I stayed in my room and I looked at magazines and I watched television and I was, you know, I had interests that the other kids didn't have. And so it was very weird. And also, you know, I looked like a girl and people, you know, I went through that whole thing of being made fun of and being an outcast. So I became, as a reaction to that, I guess, I became quite defiant and I pushed it and I, you know, dressed up more and I, you know, and so I think that it was almost like I had to move. Not quite, but it was almost like you better get out of here else you're going to get in trouble.
Did you go right to New York or where'd you?
No, I tried San Francisco first because a girlfriend of mine, there was a little music scene in Pittsburgh that was very influential. It's like in Pittsburgh, one of the exciting things about it is it's a college town. And so I gravitated towards the college town out of my neighborhood, which was pretty convenient on the bus. And I was hanging around like this, like new wave punk rock shows and things like that. And I made some friends, which wasn't so easy in my little high school town kind of thing. So I had some great friends, including the hairdresser, Louis Angelo. We went to high school together. Maybe he's also does the same kind of work as I do, and he's brilliant. And so he was a great friend, and we shared a lot of these kind of things of being different in our small town. And then we both eventually moved to New York and worked in the fashion business doing hair, which is, of course, just mind-blowing that that happened.
Mm-hmm. When you were in San Francisco, were you doing hair or that?
No. So I was on this little music scene, and I made friends with this great woman named Gail. And I had just graduated from high school, and I just knew that I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to get out of town. And Gail was moving to San Francisco after graduating from college, and she said I could come. So
I've got a question. Okay. Was your mom like during this time? Because I know how hard that type of, you know, time is, and I get the whole bedroom culture thing and the, you know, alternative music thing. Like at this point, were you kind of like, get away, mom? Or was your mom like, I see you, honey, like you got to do your thing. Like, you know, or were you kind of splitting off from her?
I think it was a combination. I think that, you know, I don't think my mother had any reference for me. And I think that there wasn't the language I'm talking 1982, I think. So, or 1981, 1982. So there wasn't that language of, quote, I see you.
I think that came out like 3 years ago. Yeah.
Yes. There wasn't anything like fluid. Yeah.
Mom, I have agency. Okay.
There wasn't anything like that. But, you know, when we talk now, I get that more.
Yeah.
That it was sort of like, you have to find yourself. This isn't the right place. I get it. But
I just imagine that's hard. That was hard. Yeah.
It was very hard because where I'm from, people don't always move away. Even there's very few gay people. There's very few, you know, I don't know how else to say it, that it was...
You had to find your people, yeah.
Yeah, I stood out, and it was a good place to get. And also, like I said, I was defiant. I wasn't the person I am now. Who's, you know, I like to make, you know, I like to get things done and be professional. I wasn't that person, so...
Interesting.
A lot has happened between then and now. But so I went to San Francisco not knowing really what I wanted to do besides to go out to nightclubs. So I went to San Francisco, and as you could imagine, that didn't last very long, you know, going to nightclubs and trying to figure out like what kind of work I could do. So then shortly after, I moved to New York. And I got involved with the nightclub scene. This was very important to me from very like kind of mid-teen to, I don't know, mid to late 20s. It was a very, very big part of my life and my culture and my community. And the community has remained. A lot of the people that I'm very close to, I know. I've met in those.
What clubs were you going to? Was this every night? What was the vibe like in New York then?
Well, I actually, I worked in nightclubs. That's what, eventually I started to work in nightclubs. That became how I survived for a while, off and on. And I worked at, there was a very seminal nightclub in a scene, and it was almost like my school was called the Pyramid Club, which was quite famous. But at the time, the Pyramid Club, like, I don't know if all nightclubs are the same, but it was really about the managers of it. You know, like, so the Pyramid Club closed a few years ago, but it was nothing to do with the place I was at because the managers were what made it. You know, like, say, like, nights.
It's not the venue, it's the vibe, yeah.
Yes, it was the vibe, exactly, well put. So I did everything there from coat check. I was in, and then there were performances. So I did drag in those days, and I was a go-go dance and drag, and I was in some bands, and I there was an amazing dressing room scene, right, where we would get ready.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And there was
it a sounds very, like fertile I, ground for the right, you know,
exactly
what we're about so, to do.
Right. So there was, and there was a sense of elders there, and there were incredible performers named Ethel Eichelberger and Augusta Machado, and they were older. I don't know. They're much. They were probably much younger, definitely much younger than I am now, but they seemed much older than me. And they had come from the, they knew people, especially Augusto knew like Candy Darling and the Warhol people. And, you know, so there was this lineage that I felt like we were a part of. And at one point, Ethel said to me, "Jimmy, you love doing your hair and makeup so much. Maybe you should do it for a job." And it kind of occurred to me because I wasn't a brilliant performer. You know, like I wasn't getting anywhere. It wasn't really becoming a profession. And
when
so,
you say performer, you mean like a musician? Are you talking about?
Yes, I was like, in bands, okay. But I couldn't, right. I wasn't a musician, like that kind of thing.
Right.
I was in some bands, but that didn't mean that I was a musician. I wasn't, I don't think I was very good. And also I would be involved in performances and drag shows and stuff. And of course it was a blast, but it was never some kind of thing that I was excelling at that it seemed like this is going to segue into a career or a job. You know, I had some fun and I was photographed some, which you may know about, and by Nan Golden.
Yes, yeah.
That stuff, you know, that lasted. But believe me, I wasn't RuPaul and Lady Bunny both come from that scene. You know, that's where I met them when they're brand new in New York. And I wasn't on that trajectory. I wasn't going to be like them.
So did you want to, so are you saying that you didn't want to keep pursuing drag? Because I heard that you were like a name. Like I've heard of Jimmy Paulette.
Right.
Yeah. Tell me about Jimmy Paulette.
Well, I guess I've never really thought about it that way. I've never really thought of it that way, but I was sort of coming to the end of that cycle and of doing drag. And, you know, being in bands and I had tried performing and I didn't really feel like I was nailing it. Like it was fun, but I didn't feel like, okay, this is my future and I'm going to keep doing this. I didn't really feel like I was good enough, to be honest. And, but I could tell you the story of my name, Jimmy Paul and Jimmy Paulette. Well, cause so whenever I went to the Pyramid Club and drag the first night to go dance when I had lived in New York for about a month and I was 19. Because I knew someone who worked there and I said, could I go dance here? And like the drag queens, and they said, yes, come, and, you know, come. And so I came and the older guys at the bar that were sitting at the bar said, what's your name? And I said, it's Jimmy. And they said, you have to have a drag name. And I said, oh, I didn't think of that. I don't know. And then one of them said, because someone had made this dress on me made out of tulle, you know, like the tulle, is that however you pronounce that? And I guess it looked French. And they said, oh, you look French, Paulette. And I said, okay. And so then my drag name was Paulette. And then Lady Bunny, who I'm very good friends with, started calling me Jimmy Paulette because I would be out at the clubs a lot, out of drag. So, you know, I was Jimmy. So she put it together in her own way and it stuck. And then to move the story up a while, when I went to work for Orbe, the genius hairdresser, he had this amazing partner named Omar, who was an agent. He had an agency for hair and makeup people. And my last name is very long. My real last name is very long and hard to pronounce. And so He said, we have to come up with a name for you. How about Jimmy Paul? And I said, okay.
Wait, without knowing about Jimmy Paulette, or did he know about Jimmy Paulette?
No, he had known Jimmy Paulette. Okay. So he made up Jimmy Paul out of Paulette.
I always thought it was your middle name. I love this story.
No. Okay. It was really supposed to be like my new last name, you know, like a stage name, I guess. Yeah. And a lot of people called me Jimmy Paul, and I never corrected them. So it's funny. I feel like I just got guided into the drag name and this name. Like I just sort of went along with it because I was pretty open to suggestions because I was, it was a survival thing. So luckily I like it. You know, I mean, it's more like it's just my name. I'm used to it. I don't dislike it, or maybe I appreciate it because it's, at this point, it's sentimental. You know, it's all these people that are all gone. Basically, almost everybody that I mentioned is no longer with us. So, you know, Omar, who made up my name, my work name, is gone. So it's a great memory of him. Ethel, who said I should go to beauty school, is gone. So, you know, it's nice to be able to have these memories.
So, it's kind of, it feels like a tattoo or something, like a permanent tattoo. Yes. You know, you mentioned the beauty school thing. You were in drag culture. Mm-hmm. I think about your work so much, and to me, it has, and this is my perception, it has mm-hmm. real hints of drag culture. You know, it feels glamorous and outsized and, you know, theatrical, and there's character in it. Like, do you see that informing your work?
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely.
Oh, good. I thought you were going to be like, you're crazy.
Or
how interesting, Jessica.
I don't think you're crazy at all. I can't help, but, you know, it's me. It's who I am. It's a very big part of who I am, as, you know, as much as like saying that my mother influences my work. My mother, I was born in 1963, so my mother was... And my mother, the other thing about my mother was that she was very young. She was 20 when I was born. So she was at the height of doing her look and her hair. And so, you know, I seen her go from, you know, bright red beehives to, you know, the Farrah Fawcett look and wearing hair, wigs and hair pieces, and then going into the 80s, early 80s, new wave, new romantic drag thing. And you know, and then being obsessed with David Bowie and Ziggy Stardust. So all of that is in my imagination, right? It's all it's all a part of my work. I do think that there is, I am sensitive about it because I've been I think that homophobia is a part of our lives. And I think that, you know, I think that I'm defensive because if somebody ever sort of described me as, oh, that guy that makes women look like drag queens, like that's something bad. I think that is, I would be, the hair on the back of my neck might go up a bit to hear that, but I would accept it because I have grown up with homophobia. And so I understand that's not going away. That's just part of the world.
Has anyone ever said that to you?
Yes. People have, you name it, people have said it.
So, wow.
You know, as a hairdresser, I think that, you know, we are, it's kind of like there is a sense of, it's the most important thing about the picture, the hair. But it's also, if a hairdresser reacts, then that's a diva hairdresser. You see what I mean? Like, so the pressure is, this is the most important thing. This is more important than world hunger. There is a gun to your head and you are going to die if the hair isn't right. If I say, I don't agree with that, to, oh, diva hairdresser, you know, and diva hairdresser could be gay hairdresser,
absolutely,
drag
absolutely.
Queen hairdresser. You follow me?
Yeah.
I have, mm-hmm. yes, I have experienced that. Yes.
Yeah.
And I roll with it because acceptance, you know, I it's like, yes, I am gay. I am, you know, yeah. I am part of this, long line of diva hairdressers, and that's let's move on. You know, let's do it. Do you want a ponytail? Like what? You know, tell me what you want. Let's not make her a drag queen. I don't know. I'll take the wig off. I don't know. Let's just get through the day. You know.
Okay, everyone, guess what I did last night? I slept in my Honeylove bra. I don't think I've ever slept in a bra before. Usually, I am so excited to take off my bra at the end of the day, there would be no chance I would lay down in it. But Honeylove bras are that comfortable. And if you're someone who does like to sleep in a bra for a little extra support, I feel like the Honeylove crossover bra should be your sleeping bra. Did I just coin a thing, sleeping bra? I don't know if they'll approve of that, but I love the idea. Obviously, you're gonna wear it out all the time too, because Honeylove's bras feature supportive bonding that eliminates the need for uncomfortable wires. Plus, they're made with a fabric that's so soft, it feels like a second skin. Is it spring cleaning time in your house? I know it is in mine. Clean out your bra drawer, get a few from Honeylove. They have the V-neck bra that's smooth and seamless and hardware free. And then my personal favorite is the crossover bra with adjustable straps and a hook back closure. And of course, again, no underwire in that one either. The Honeylove supportive bonding lifts and supports without those uncomfortable wires. And while you're at it, why not pair your Honeylove bra with their matching shapewear, or maybe a pair of their breathable, versatile leggings. Treat yourself to the best bras on the market and save 20% off at honeylove.com/mascara. Use our exclusive link to get 20% off. It's honeylove.com/mascara. And then after you purchase, they're going to ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them that we here at Fat Mascara sent you. Honeys, you deserve this. Again, that website is honeylove.com/mascara for 20% off.
All right, it's not often that we talk about supplements, but when we do, you know that we mean it, all right? Every day I do my skincare routine, and that is a cleanse. I moisturize. Of course, I pop a little antioxidant in there. I'll do a little serum underneath there. But what is non-negotiable for me lately is I take a supplement. That is my Ritual Hyacera. It's a wrinkle support skin supplement, which is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and improve skin smoothness. I'll take that.
I'll take it too. Ritual Hyacera is a once daily skin supplement. Jess said clinically proven. Let me give you the deets. In a clinical study, Hyacera led to a 3.6 time reduction in crow's feet wrinkles within 90 days as compared to placebo. Jess and I have been taking it more than 90 days. Let me tell you, it works. Plus, Ritual Hyacera has led to a 2.9 times increase in skin smoothness in the same amount of times. It's rigorously tested and validated by a third party for allergens, microbes, and heavy metals. You don't always know if a supplement does that. Ritual also has industry-leading sustainability standards. They use scientific tools to select lower carbon packaging, love that, prioritize sustainably sourced ingredients, and set ambitious climate goals. Plus, female-founded, B Corp, meaning they're holding themselves accountable to not just their company's financial health, but also the health of the people and our planet. You gotta love that.
Yes, okay. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust.
Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/mascara. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/mascara for 25% off. Okay, so there are some stories about my mom's life that I never get tired of hearing, and they're usually the ones in which she's trying to right some injustice and then ends up annoying the people in power, and I love that about her. Anyway, just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for my family forever. It's called Storyworth. StoryWorth helps you preserve memories and stories for the mother figure in your life or any of your family or chosen family. Here's how it works. Each week, StoryWorth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. The prompts are really good. The kind of things we ask guests here at Fat Mascara, little things like, what's your favorite board game? And more important things like, what's the best advice you've ever gotten? StoryWorth makes the writing process a breeze. All your loved one needs to do is respond to the email with a story, long or short, doesn't matter. You'll be emailed a copy of what they wrote, but they'll also be collected. So you'll get to enjoy the retelling of the stories and probably learn some new things in the process. Then, after that year of fun, StoryWorth automatically compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book. Even though I know some of my mom's best stories, I love that the weekly prompts are helping to uncover more details and that they'll be collected in one place for me to revisit and read through. Don't think I'm not going to pull this keepsake book out at our next family get-together to share some of them. Listen, everyone loves StoryWorth. It has more than 25,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot, with millions of stories preserved since they were founded over 10 years ago. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift that you'll cherish for years. StoryWorth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to StoryWorth.com/mascara. That's StoryWorth.com/mascara to save $10 on your first purchase. Do you smile a little, though, in the last couple of years as so many beauty tricks and styles from the drag community have made their way into the mainstream? Are you like, oh, now you want us here? Now we're going to, you know, false lashes that, you know, baking, contouring, these makeup things that all got their start in the drag community and are just, I mean, sometimes people reference where they came from, but not always. How do you feel about that?
You know what? It isn't really come into my consciousness. I don't really think of it. It's not a thing I really identify with. I think that my mother wore false eyelashes, and I remember them going out of fashion and me telling her, "Mom, it's time to stop wearing the false eyelashes." Like the power switch happened where my mother was taking my advice. And, so I think that, I don't really identify with the current drag queens. You know, also I haven't done drag for over 30 years. So it's not something that's like right in my consciousness, but, if I ever thought, and to me, it all starts with women, right? I mean, my mother wore false eyelashes and hair pieces and wigs. And so, you know, I think of it, I don't credit drag queens for inventing any of that. But I think if somebody wanted to give anybody credit, that's okay by me.
Yeah. You mentioned that you worked with Orbe. Is that how you got your foot in the door with the beauty industry or even his, the agent he was working with and you got an agent?
Yes.
How'd that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was very early. I had a little bit before that. I do want to shout out to in the nightclubs. I met this great makeup artist named Leslie Chilks. And I met Orlando Pizza, the brilliant hairdresser, and I met Danilo, who I was very good friends with. And they were idols of mine. And I guess at some point, even though I didn't have any self-esteem, I guess subconsciously I thought, I want to be like them. You know, they are surviving in New York, which was a big part of my desire was to survive because I wasn't doing great with that. Just, you know, place home and place to live and, you know, nice clothes and all the things that, you know, nice dinners or whatever, like just the basics, let's say. I guess the basics, nice clothes and nice dinners is a little bit beyond basic, but I wanted just to be able to survive, and I was struggling with that. So I saw that these people were more than surviving. They were flourishing and they were living the lives that they wanted, and they weren't conformists, right? They were outside of the box. I didn't want to change the person I was. I didn't want to become conservative, right? I didn't want to, like, I couldn't work on Wall Street if no matter what, but I didn't want to look like that. I didn't want to live like that. So I saw this sort of alternative lifestyle that they were doing as far as, and they were in the beauty industry. And my first thought was like, oh, I'm going to do what my mom does. Because I had admired so much what my mom did. I didn't think I could do it. I didn't think I would be good enough to do it. Wow. I didn't think I had the gift that my mother had. She approaches hair in a very different way than I do, and almost mathematical. And that's not the way my mind works. So it was a very tentative start. And the only reason I got to go to beauty school was at the time you could get a grant and a loan in New York City to go to beauty school. So basically, like, I went in completely broke and started the next day, which I don't know if that would
I was
exist.
About to say, does that exist anymore? Like,
I doubt it. And so, and only because I lost all my ID, I got a grant and a loan with a Social Security card. So just for context, mm-hmm. it was a very different time. And so I, when I went to beauty school, I didn't do well. I didn't have the hand-eye coordination, but I had something that people responded to, and I could feel that. And so I went to work as an assistant in some hair salons. I got fired from the first one. Then I went to another one, and it wasn't and all they wanted to hire me to be was a colorist assistant. And I was terrible at color. It's quite, again, it's quite mathematical. There's formulas and maybe you know, formulas and things in color. And I was just terrible at it, but they were nice to me and it was my job, but it really felt like a job. And and then I just started to feel more comfortable around hair, which I think is something that people don't realize. Like, just touching people every day and just the process of that took a few years and for me to get used to and to be able to really look at women and really look at hair and really start to get my hand-eye coordination. None of this stuff came natural to me. Even though I was doing my own hair and all the drag stuff, I just had no natural ability. And that I got through beauty school was really something. I can't believe it. In fact, I was terrified to take the test because I didn't think I could do. And there's in New York, in all of the states, you have to take a test to get you a license in hairdressing. It's called the state board test. And I never took
it. I heard there was a finger wave on it, right?
Which I could never do. You actually hit on the one thing that I was terrified of. I thought I could never do a finger wave. I could never do a perm. Any of the things that took a lot of dexterity, I was terrified to take. And in fact, I didn't take the test for of quite a few years later. And then I took the test and I didn't do any of that stuff great, but the guy was nice enough to pass me. And I was already working in a salon without a license, so which is, I guess, illegal. But I got away with it for a few years. So anyway, then I started to see these ads in Paper Magazine for Orbe Salon. And I had just started to look at the credits in magazines. So I was really, it was really at the time of sort of the dawn of Stephen Meisel. This is maybe 1984, and Stephen Sprouse. And Stephen Sprouse was a huge influence on me. I don't want to say just on my hairdressing, on me, period. Like, absolutely everything that he represented, I just became like a groupie. And then I would see the name Stephen Meisel attached to him. So I started to look at his photographs and, Terry Toy was a muse and model and Terry's trans. And I always identified with that community very strongly. And it really felt like something that I felt very close to, as opposed to sort of, like Yves Saint Laurent or even Calvin Klein. Calvin Klein seemed preppy, which I didn't identify with. Yves Saint Laurent seemed like it was very for rich people in a way that I could admire, but I didn't identify with, where Sproul seemed to capture the energy of the New York City street and youth culture. So that was a big influence on me. And so in the paper magazine, which I loved, it had these ads for Orbe Salon, and Stephen Meisel had taken the pictures. They're great pictures. And at the same time, my friend Danilo started to work for Orbe. And he told me, and I thought, that sounds like the hottest place in New York. That sounds like the fantasy place to work. And if you know the history of hairdressing, there's always been like the hottest hair salon. And like in the 70s, there was a place called Sinandre. And I always loved the idea of that. And I used to read this in my bedroom culture, read about these kind of places in New York. So I thought like, well, that's going to be the new Sinandre. That's going to be the new Sassoon, the new hot place. So I decided to sort of start all over as an assistant and go there. Well, I walked in and they were desperate for an assistant. Like the other, there was only one other assistant, and she had to go away for her to see her family or something. And they were like, start tomorrow. And it was just one of those magical things. And that I said, oh, I know Danilo, and that's all that they really needed. And so I just got taken into this family. And like I said, eventually Orbe, Omar made up my name, and then a little while later, this woman I knew from the nightclubs named Susan Price started to work for Orbe, and it was like, oh, I know you. And later on, Susan went on her own, and I went with her, and she's still my agent today. So,
and you started booking jobs at the magazines you had loved and were reading, and fashion shows too, yeah?
Yeah, so, I mean, really, it was a combination of being an assistant and then working, doing my own little shoots, which is still, I guess, the way it goes today for new people. But I was assisting Danilo and Orbe on incredible projects like fashion shows and so on and so forth. More than shoots, I was really assisting more on shows, but Orbe was doing fantastic shows, like, for instance, the Perry Ellis grunge Marc Jacobs show and, you know, things like that.
You were an assistant at that show?
Yes, I was. And I'm very proud of that.
What did you think when you saw the girls walking out? Were you like, this is the moment, or is it just another show?
Well, again, very similar to Sprouse. It felt like I know this. I'm comfortable with this. I know this. So and then when I started shooting, grunge was, I understood grunge. And so it was a huge catalyst for me, because if you know the history, it went from this sort of supermodel glamour to abruptly to grunge. And some of the hairdressers did not make the transition. And it just, in some of them, stopped working. I don't really know why, because I didn't interview them, but it just wasn't their look. It wasn't their look, and it wasn't something that they understood or liked, maybe. And all of a sudden, I started to get more and more work. But I do want to say I was very lucky. Because Orbe was so hot, you know, so in demand, the agency that, you know, booking people would call for the agency for Orbe, and then they would say, like, who else do you have if he's not available? So it really went down awesome. The line to baby me. And so I was doing these jobs for like magazines like Red Book and Working Women and things like that, which of course has nothing to do with what my aesthetic
grunge.
Was.
Totally grunge.
or this is actually pre-grunge, so I was still trying to go glamorous. And because it was all just in a couple of years. It was sort of like movie stars, 40s, 60s, whatever, to grunge, and very quickly. But it was a great lesson in focus, because one thing that studio hairdressing takes is a tremendous amount of focus, which I had zero. I had no muscle for that, right? I had not developed focusing at all. I was in the clouds. You know, I didn't know anything about focusing on anything. I barely went to, you know, I didn't go to college, or I didn't. I wasn't that academic. So I it was the first time I ever had to like be still and stare, and maybe a hair falls out of place and then run in, and you know, all of that stuff. So I learned how to do that. I learned how to be on set. I learned how to be how to navigate the business, and in a way that nobody would see, because people that were didn't look at the credits of Working Woman or Red Book as much.
Stakes were a little lower, yeah.
Yeah, the stakes were, thank you. So it was a great, great thing. And then, you know, then I started to do like front of the book pictures for interview or something. And then the big first success I had was my friend David LaChapelle. He didn't. He wasn't the David LaChapelle that you know, but he was. His pictures didn't look like that yet. But he booked me some because I was very good friends with a guy named Joshua Jordan, who's a photographer. But we were all friends from the nightclubs, and Josh was styling, and he got me on some of David's shoots. So what happened was I had a portfolio. And it wasn't just test shoots. It was magazine pictures. So this was also a little successes that. And so then it just sort of snowballed a little bit. And I started to do interesting things. And then the English people all started to come to New York, and like Melanie Ward and different English people came, and Guido and Dick Page. And then that brought an energy into the fashion world. And somehow I was okay to them. So I started to work with them. I worked with Camilla Nickerson really early when she came to Vogue. So I'm talking must have been 93-ish. So all of a sudden I was doing baby stuff. Then I went to work for Guerin. And then that was an entire new education.
This you went to work for him in his salon?
Yes.
Okay.
So I had left working for Oribe. I had started being represented by Susan Price. And then I started to work for Guerin. And Guerin was a very different point of view of hairdressing. And a very disciplined, that I, again, had no reference for. A very disciplined approach to a lot of things that was a huge influence on me, and it very, very, very grateful to all of these people that influenced me. But Guerin really changed my work ethic and my, again, focus and navigation. These are crucial to hair, to doing
it
hair.
It seems like all these people just keep on tightening and tightening and tightening the wheel or like the screw.
Yes, that is a really good way to put it. And you know, I learned so much about hair products and things working for all of them. But Guerin, I think what happens is when that period from going to an assistant to being on your own is an incredibly fertile learning time, because I knew a lot, but I didn't know a lot. So all of a sudden, because I had some confidence, all of a sudden I started to connect the dots working for Guerin. And all of a sudden, when I first started working for Guerin on fashion shows, I would get everything that I did redone. You know, somebody, Guerin would say, like, do that, somebody else do that over. And then I went through the process of them saying, give them to Jimmy, give her to Jimmy. And
that's
then I saw that and I was like, so it did amazing. It's an amazing thing to have respect from your peers or from your, your above peers. Mm-hmm. What would that, the boss. It was, yeah. It was amazing to have that validation. And it really changed my confidence.
Was there a moment in your career? I mean, you've had a long career, but was there a moment or a goal that you were seeking out this whole time? Like, I know I'm going to make it when, you know, I book this campaign or I'm working with this designer or model? Like, is there something you've been chasing this whole time, or something that you chased and now you've done it and you feel pretty great?
Well, I think that, like I said early on in our discussion, that Steven Meisel was a very big influence on me. So I thought, you know, that would be the ultimate, right? And and then being around Orbe and Garin, an American Vogue cover, seemed like the ultimate, right? And these two things. And again, absolute magic. I met Steven Meisel, and he became a sort of, without saying it, somewhat of a mentor. And we knew each other socially a little bit, and through his partner Benjamin, who was a dear friend of mine, and so I got to know him socially. Again, this is so much more than anything I'd ever expected. You know, I never thought I would know someone like that, and then started to book me on some jobs. Again, I thought, like, this is a fluke. I'm not ready for this. And it started to snowball, and I got to do a bunch with Steven, and including an American Vogue cover in, like, 1996 with my first American Vogue cover was 1996 with Winona Ryder. And, that was a turning point, of course. That was a turning point. And I think it would still be a turning point for anyone to get that, but that was a difference. Now the thing was, it was sort of like I'm sure to everyone that witnessed that. I don't, not to say that people are thinking about me, but you know, that they thought that was lucky, and I think it was lucky. I also, but to what happened after that was to keep it going. That's where the real work came. That's where the real work came. Because it's one thing to be a fluke and to be young and to get an opportunity, but it's longevity.
Mm-hmm.
You
said something really interesting, and I was doing some reading, obviously, before the interview, interview, and you know, you said something in an interview. You said that in the mid 2000s, you got a little complacent, you got a little bored. I'm paraphrasing. I'm not going to read this whole long graph.
That's
back
okay.
To you. But you said that you know, you did start to lose some clients, and you know, your work started to slow down. Then, but from there, it was a real turning point. You said you got inspired, you worked on your craft and yourself. You took some chances, and you did some really avant-garde editorial, and you started to build. You had to push yourself, and the idea of something being taken away from you was the best fuel. And I just thought that was super, I thought that was really cool and vulnerable that you said that to the interviewer. I thought that it was really relatable, you know, that careers have highs and lows. And that moment of, you know, having something, you know, I think we all have that, you know, that moment in our career that, like, you know, it's success is like, you know, it's not something that you can, like, it's not a constant. It's not something that you can ride out for the rest of your career. Can you tell us more about that time and what sort of work were you doing?
Well, at some point, from the absolute thrill of starting, right, of working with Steven Meisel for Italian Vogue, or working on projects with Camilla Nickerson at Vogue, or, you know, Joe McKenna was a huge early supporter. Now, these are absolutely thrilling. It's the tippity top of creativity. Yes. And what happens is I became spoiled. And I became spoiled by the results and by the dates, you know, which were really often very enjoyable. Not that they weren't sometimes really difficult, but that they were, it just felt like you're around excellence. And one thing who's ever listening to this might not know is that in the fashion business, those kind of jobs that I'm naming are not lucrative. They're not how you make your money.
A lot of people do not know that. They are not lucrative
yes.
at all.
Right. So I probably somebody might think like, oh, working for a magazine like that is going to be, you're rich. Well, it's not. But what you get from that is you get your, the payment is really that it says my name on it. And then what happens, the way the business works is then you use that, those photos to get advertising work. And advertising is a whole nother ball game. There are a lot more people to please. There's art directors. There's clients. There's the people that own the companies. There's a lot of compromise, and there's a lot of it can seem tedious. The days could be really long. The days could be, you know, they might not care about my hair that I did very much, you know, or whatever. And I just sort of felt like I reacted to it. You know, I sabotaged it. I didn't like it. And then what happens is, you know, you get in the New York sort of cycle. I think, oh, I have to do this thing. Oh, I have to buy an apartment. That's what everybody does, right? You have to, you know, these kind of things. And all of a sudden the bills pile. And it's like, I can't just work on Italian Vogue I just can't do paper magazine every day and have fun with my friends. I'm not in a nightclub. You know, this thing happened where, and I was doing some clients where it was really long days, you know, very boring photographs, very commercial, but it paid and I just didn't care. And I started, and I think people felt that. I don't know, because people don't, in the fashion business, the only way you find out that people don't like what you're doing is that you don't get hired again. Like, usually people won't tell you, Jimmy, you should do a little bit better. You should try a little harder. It's usually like, yeah, just use somebody else, you know, because it's freelance. So anyway, I saw that happening. And I saw that, like, okay, this thing that was such a dream, I was losing my gratitude for, because I was doing the wrong things. And I realized that I had to get back to a place of appreciation, gratitude, love, inspiration. And so, yeah, I just started to create opportunity by doing younger or smaller magazines, like in just finding projects that would be inspiring, and also working on my craft. Also, I started to work on, I draw very amateurly, but I started to do these drawing classes, like just to have a creative outlet, so that like, if I did some beautiful, in my mind, hairstyle that took a lot of focus, energy, concentration, and somebody on the job said that they didn't like it, it didn't feel like they were like killing my creativity. And absolutely, it's because, you know, in the fashion business, it has to go fast. It's limited. So if I do some giant constructed hairstyle and it doesn't seem right to the photographer or the editor, it's my job to be part of the team to brush it right out. And no matter how beautiful I might think it is, and put it in a ponytail or whatever's right for the, I'm being hard on ponytails in this interview, I know.
But, you've done some very glamorous ponytails.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind a Jimmy Paul pony, please.
But we have to give you one. I absolutely love ponytails, and I've worked very, fashion ponytails are not easy. They are an art, especially perfect ones that you see in fashion shows. Oh. A lot of people cannot do them, and I practice and practice and practice, and I've taught them a lot. Anyway, that's another story. But yes, so having my own creative outlets let me come back to the place of, let's do what's best for the picture. What do you want? You want me to give you an idea? Here's an idea. What do you think? You don't like it? What about this? You have hats. Let me help you pin it on. Like at one point, the hats were like an enemy. You know, I was like, hats. Oh no, what am I doing here? I had to get out of the bed for hats.
You're crushing my soul.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Exactly. Thank you. You put it in words that I didn't have, crushing my soul. You know, and at some point I realized this is not my soul. This is my job. And I'm here to do a service. And I am in the service industry. And I had to.
I will go get some hat pins.
Yes. Yes.
This is I don't know why this is like hitting me really hard today.
Because we've both been on set and been in that exact
position. I literally, you're going to laugh. I can tell you more about the story another time offline, but I was literally rushing around Jen Knows to get hat pins like at 7 a.m. like this time last year. Hat pins. But yes. I'm not a hairdresser, but I get your... I empathize with what you're saying. And I love that you turned something that could have just... crushed your soul. You could have been like, well, nobody wants me, you know, and you could have just like gone off and done, you know, whatever. And instead you were like, no, I'm going to find my creative spirit. And now, you know, you're juggling your cool avant-garde stuff and your big money stuff, but you also do like, you've managed to marry them both. Oh my God. Have you seen people go look up the show you did for Moschino with Karen Elson. Holy cow. I mean, that is not like a small potatoes creative endeavor. That is the freaking Jeremy Scott Moschino show. Karen Elson's hair is amazing. It is not like, there is a hat, but it's not tucked up. It's not hidden under a hat. Like the hair is a main event.
Thank you.
So, no, it's just you constantly turn out new tricks. I don't know where you get these new ideas, but I think your story, and I brought up that quote not to like bring up like a, so I'm gonna bring up a sad old quote. Like, I think that quote is so important for anyone who is feeling kind of like just like in a rut, or especially like, I think this weird kind of coming out of the pandemic, are we like moment, yeah, has a lot of people kind of like just feeling uninspired. So I don't know. I really think your story is awesome.
Thank you.
All right, Jen, should we do the FM5?
We do a little like personality, like dig deep kind of speed round of questions. Are you up for it, Jim?
Yeah, just a speed round. It's light, okay. It's quick, it's fun.
Whatever you want.
What's the first beauty or grooming product you remember falling in love with? Little Jimmy watching mom, maybe?
Gina Tay. It's an after...
Gina Tay.
Oh, yeah.
An after bath splash.
The splash, yeah, with the yellow jar, with the black... Yeah. Of course. I haven't heard that one in a while. If there's one rule you wish everybody would follow, what would it be?
To have empathy for everybody that's on set.
I like the ending. It's on set.
I thought it was just about like
just
empathy.
On set.
No,
I thought we were talking about work, but yeah.
No, I love it. That's great. I think that's great.
Okay. What's your favorite indulgent snack?
Chocolate.
And what's the most played song on your playlist right now? Or ever?
I love old kind of obscure disco, and that, so it always changes, but there's a song that I've been playing lately called I forget the name of it, but I love all that kind of stuff, or some stuff from my childhood, but I love old disco, and I love this singer called Viola Wills. I love stuff that's sort of like, it just conjures up stuff from a particular time in my childhood. I love that kind of, I find it very comforting.
Yeah. If there was to be a movie made of your life, meanwhile, I feel like we just did the audio version of the movie of your life. I love that.
I want to see it. I want to see the movie of
your life. So, okay, let's vision. There's going to be a movie made of your life. Who should narrate it?
Linda Evangelista.
Of course. She's a Fat Mascara former guest.
Yes.
So we'll just call
her. She has
her
a beautiful voice.
I'm sure you guys are like tighter than we are with her. So, yeah.
In my She's dreams. Awesome.
She's got such a breathy voice. It was so nice.
Just because of her, because she's a hero. So it was just my first instinct.
Oh, no, nice. I think that's the way you should go with it. So we'll make sure that's noted in a movie of your life that will come out. This was so awesome to catch up with you and hear some of the stories of how you got to where you are in your career.
Thank you.
More to come. Oh, Jimmy, thank you. This is great.
We hope you enjoyed the show.
It's your reviews and feedback that help us make the podcast even better. Head over to iTunes to rate and review us or email your thoughts to info@fatmascara.com.
We also want to answer your beauty questions and hear what products you love. To share a Raise a Wand product review or to ask a beauty question, email us at info@fatmascara.
If you send it as a voice memo file, we can even share your voice on the podcast. You can also do that by leaving us a voice message. Our phone number in the United States is 646-481-8182.
Thanks so much for listening.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.